crazy times filled with crazy players. Sacred Legions believes we need to focus on the people behaving decently in this otherwise shockingly indecent society. As a recent 24-hour Brian Eno documentary marathon pointed out to me, we're a species of inputs and outputs. At sacredlegions.org, we seek to provide you with inputs of all our available program episodes and outputs of our growing resources for volunteer and self-care organizations. Hell, we would love to have you add to our ever-growing list of organizations who would benefit from volunteer service or those allowing you to find support. As a side note, I recently added 5 organizations this past week dedicated to helping LGBTQIA+ individuals because despite current evidence to the contrary, as Kurt Vonnegut once wrote, "God damn it, children, you've got to be kind." One last bit of encouragement, make a Kurt Vonnegut book one of your future inputs. It'll help you understand where we get some of our wonderful inspiration for this program. And as Kurt Vonnegut also said, it'll make your soul grow. Welcome to episode 4 of Sacred Legions. I'm Max Goller.
And I'm Pat LaMarche.
Pat, I'm excited to finally talk to people who share your passion for helping the unhoused. I kind of got to know you through work that you did with homeless advocacy and all that. Can you introduce our secular Saint Diane Nyland and tell us a little bit about her and her partner for today?
Oh, can I? Diane Nyland is just a hero of mine. She's this amazing, wonderful woman who I was writing a column for the Bangor Daily News. I was working at a homeless shelter and I was writing a column because I started my career in the media. And Diane was out there in the world. If you don't follow Diane Nyland on Facebook, you need to do it before this conversation's over, because if you want to know information about what's going on in the world of homelessness and people both advocating for it and then the people who are dropping the ball, which unfortunately the second is a little more prevalent, Diane scours the news sources every morning and finds little things to talk about and big things to talk about what's going on in the world of homelessness. And I just happened to have been in New York City the weekend before I wrote that column that she read. And I just happened to be looking at statistics. They had statistics on homelessness all over the subways of New York City, which was pretty progressive, really, for a city to be posting this. Hey, this is how we're dropping the ball. And so that was also the night, the week that in a debate, this is how long ago it was, in a debate, it was found out that Sarah Palin, John McCain's running mate, had written notes on the palm of her hand. And so when she was at the debate, she was reading the notes from the palm of her hand. And I said, too bad, this is what I'm thinking in the subway in New York, too bad that Sarah Palin's hands aren't as big as the subway wall. Maybe she'd have some good statistics. So I wrote a column. Don't pick on Sarah Palin for writing notes on her hands. Just pick on her because her hands are too small. And Diane read this thing and wrote to me and said that she traveled. She had given up everything in the material world, basically, got an RV and started traveling the country and said, I'm going to be in your neck of the woods. You're my kind of gal or guy. She didn't know because I'm named Pat, which has worked really well for me for most of my life, that I'm kind of gender neutral out there. And he said, can we meet up? And I went to see her with my son. We went and met her at a campground. And my next column was about what a real hero looks like in the United States of America. And that's you, Diane.
Careful.
And now you're a secular saint as well, just so that we could clarify that.
Yeah. So Diane, tell folks about, well, I guess you worked in a shelter that was a refurbished incinerator, if that tells you what we think about people experiencing homelessness. But tell us about your foray into education of children and youth experiencing homelessness.
Well, first of all, let me just say thanks for having me here, because if you look too deeply, you're going to see the tarnished of the saint. So, but it's, yeah, I'll just let it slide for now. But so, yeah, I was running a shelter and we had a family staying at the shelter that the mom came to me because the school district where her kids had been attending and doing well, actually, this was in the summertime. So she tried to re-enroll her kids in school and was told no, she couldn't do that because she was staying at the shelter now, and that was out of district. And at the time, now this goes back way back to 1993, the family had become homeless, but there was a law, the McKinney Law. It was not McKinney-Vento at the time, but it was a federal law that basically said, yeah, kids could maybe go back to the same school if they were homeless. Maybe, not really. But so a few of us kind of pushed that with the school district, and they refused to let the mom in. And the long story is told in my first book, Crossing the Line, Taking Steps to End Homelessness. But the basic story was that the mom lost the court fight, and that pushed us to do a homeless education law in Illinois, which passed in 1994. So that got me really into this whole issue, and it's now a federal law and all this. And
because of Diane's work, millions and millions of children have gone to school, in the school of their choosing.
Yeah, well, yeah. So they're mad at me because they had to go to school, I guess. While I was doing what I was doing, Diana was the head of the National Center for Homeless Education, which is at the time was working with the Department of Education to spread the word about the McKinney-Vento Act and all the business that schools needed to know about kids getting in there. So I met her several times at different conferences, and you know, we got along pretty good, and that was always a good thing. So I just always had deep respect for her work. So she retired way back in, oh, I don't know, maybe 2017? She came up to me and just said something about she's retired and she wanted to work for Hear Us. And I'm like, well, it's just me.
Hear Us, the organization that you started when you left running shelters and got out into the real world, which you can read more about at hearus.us. Of course, we'll have that up on the website.
Anyhow, we talked and she wanted to do something. So she worked on and led the effort to write the Charlie book, 60 Ways to Help Homeless Kids. I helped her, but she did the lion's share of the work. And it has been a book that has been really, really helpful in lots of ways. So I moved into North Carolina not too long ago, and she lives in North Carolina, and we've gotten together, and we decided to conspire on our new project, which we'll probably talk about later. So Diane is a very cool person that she just doesn't take any nonsense either. So that's, but she's very nice about it. Unlike me, sometimes I'm not that nice, but yeah.
Well, the first thing I'm going to state about this is that Sacred Legions is constantly pushing for people to get involved in volunteer activities. And we put up on our website places that you can go to volunteer in different organizations and help out. I'm really excited that you were yourself finding an organization that didn't even have any volunteer capability and got yourself involved with them. That's fantastic. Can you tell us how you came to have this passion for the unhoused, and what prompted you to reach out to Diane Nylon and work with them?
Well, I think I'm probably a real testament to the power of talking to people or hearing from people with lived experience. This is like, oh gosh, they're early 90s. I was living in West Virginia and I was actually doing some interesting work there. I was teaching at a college primarily with first generation students from rural West Virginia, which is, you know, interesting in and of itself. And just, I was one of the few people that just really loved these students. Most people were thinking that, oh, well, they shouldn't be in college and they don't know how to do things. And I just, you know, they were just so rich and so honest. And that's, I mean, that's kind of for people from backgrounds of poverty. One thing you'll get from them is just, you know, pure, unadulterated honesty. And I love that. I always love that. From there, I moved on to teaching for an education organization and met up with someone who wanted to start the National Center for Homeless Education based out of the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. I was kind of interested, and she said, well, you know, we want you to come and work for us. And I said, well, you know, I'm in West Virginia. That's hard. And she invited me to a homeless conference, what is now the National Association for the Education of Homeless Children and Youth. And it was really sort of a, you know, burgeoning grassroots organization. And they didn't know how to do a whole lot of things for putting on a conference. But the one thing they did do is that they knew to invite people who were experiencing homelessness and have them talk. And that was kind of the heart and soul of this conference. And just being there and listening to people, I made my decision immediately to move to North Carolina and begin working for the National Center for Homeless Education. And, you know, back in those days, contracts with the Department of Education were a lot easier to navigate. The homeless education program has always been sort of the stepchild, like, just don't cause us any trouble and spend the money well and, you know, go do what you're going to do. So we sort of set up our own template for this National Technical Assistance Center to support the Department of Education. And the heart and soul of that project was our helpline. So every day, I mean, this was widely advertised across the country. So every day we actually were in touch with people who were parents who were experiencing homelessness and school districts that were trying to figure out how to serve homeless children. And, you know, that's been sort of the foundation for the center for 25 years.
Diana, I have a question. People ask me this all the time, but why? But why do you care? Was there something in your youth? Was there something in your education that when you get surrounded by people who are just really decent and up against it, you gravitate? I mean, to go to North Carolina for a conference and say, okay, I'll move to North Carolina, that's not an ordinary behavior, right? That's unique, right?
You know, I really think it was the teaching that I did. I think it was, you know, I taught at this university with these students for about 10 years and just day after day, just, and these were students, you know, primarily from impoverished backgrounds and just really getting face to face with their challenges and their struggles and knowing, you know, my background was not that, and knowing there was such a disparity that it just really pointed out to me the importance of trying to get people to sort of bridge that divide, to help people understand what these students were going through. And I think that just sort of, and a lot of my students were homeless as well. I mean, they were kind of bouncing around and sleeping in the parking lot in their cars. So, I mean, that was really my first introduction to the youth that were homeless, and just lots of other challenges with single parents and health issues and just lots of things that these students were facing. So I think, you know, that kind of engendered that sensitivity in me and the importance of really sort of focusing my life on people that were less, you know, fortunate than what I was in my background, but also helping other people understand that.
Yeah. Well, that's impressive. So you have this academic background that brought you into an experience where you were able to meet people who were really, I mean, I have always been so impressed, because if you want something solved, give it to a person experiencing homelessness, because they're problem solvers like you can't even imagine. You know, all the obstacles of just feeding, clothing, and sleeping that the rest of us sort of take for granted. It's a pain in the neck when the microwave breaks and I can't just heat something up, right? But these are people who literally they can't get groceries because they have nowhere to store them. They can't, I mean, there's just a level of difficulty. So you came from an academic background and met that. And Diane, you were on the other side where you started out in shelters. And then... Well, learn, you know, started getting into this academic world with the federal agencies and the state agencies. And so did you meet in the middle?
No, I suppose we met in the middle. But, you know, I realized that advocacy requires everybody that you can get to help on all sorts of levels. So, I mean, Diana was certainly providing, just through her work with the National Center, she was providing huge amounts of material that was so absolutely helpful for those of us out trying to make things happen. So she was certainly a natural teammate in all of this. And so when she offered to help and, you know, tag on with me, it's like, alrighty, I got somebody on my back here watching my back, because she sees things differently than I do, but we're both looking at the same, you know, issue and trying to make something good happen. So
I think you have four books, right? Charlie book that's the 60 Ways to Help a Homeless Kid, right?
Yeah.
So the Charlie book, tell us who Charlie is.
Well, Charlie he was a boy and actually from West Virginia originally. So that's a connection. But he was at our shelter with his mom. And my friend Pat Van Doren, a photojournalist, took a picture of Charlie that just was so endearing that we used his picture and his likeness with his mom's permission. He was 4 years old at the time. We used his image to pass our Illinois Education for Homeless Children Act, which we called the Charlie Bill. And so his picture has just endeared himself to people all over. I mean, when you see it, you'll just go, oh my God, that is like the cutest kid. And look at his size, his belly hanging out and his cat and shoes are on the wrong feet and all, you know, I mean, he just represents every kid that's experiencing homelessness. And that's Charlie. And so we were able to use his image on the book cover and in the name, and it kind of gives an identity to the book that I think is important.
And then, so you've got a more recent collaboration. Let's go there. So fast forward 7 years from the 2017 Charlie book, and you have another book in the meantime called Dismayed and Driven that we'll chat about for another time. But tell us about the new collaboration on the Three Melissas.
So I'm traveling around the country in a van, which is my home, a year and a half or so ago. And I've been interviewing families experiencing homelessness all over the country, putting their films together with their interviews and, you know, doing everything I could do to raise the issue of family homelessness, which is one of the most obscure issues that we have in our society today. And so I'm driving and I'm thinking, what else can we do? What else can I do? Yeah. And somehow the idea of, you know, women, the moms talking about homelessness and what their challenges were, that kind of, it's like, that's going to keep it real. That's instead of me talking about it. And so then I was like, oh, okay, what, Melissa, somehow the name Melissa came to me, and I've interviewed and stayed in touch with three moms named Melissa that are really just amazing in all sorts of ways. And I'm like, Melissa, Melissa, what about if we did a book? I did a book, but at the time I didn't really know Diana was going to do this. But so do a book of these moms talking about what it's like to be homeless and what it takes to survive homelessness and give an inside look. And so I thought about that and I'm like, well, that's bigger than me. So I checked with Diana first and, ran that idea by her. And she's like, sure, she's in on it. And talked to the three Melissas and they were more than in on it. So that's the short story of how that got started. And yeah.
That's one thing I really love about this too. You've got two books, the Charlie book, the Melissa book, that are practical guides for people. They're self-help. And that's one of the things that we're trying to promote at Sacred Legions. So that to me is exciting that you've had those books that are telling people, if you're experiencing this, here's some guides that might help you get through it.
Well, yeah, we thought that was pretty important. And I'm talking more than Diana at this point.
Well, Diana, you get sucked in by Diane. And trust me, I know how that feels. You get sent in by Diane, and what you take this phone call, and what are you thinking? What's the first thing that pops into your head?
I think there are many things about the three Melissas, and one is these are really extraordinary women, and but then in a lot of ways, and I think one of the ideas we tried to promote in the book is that they're kind of every mother. I mean, the thing about these women, and they can talk about their experiences in such detail and with such vividness that I think it really reaches out to people. But, you know, the things that come across with them is that they're just fierce mothers. And anything they do, it's going to be in the service of and for the health and welfare of their kids. And I think in that regard, I think it really does appeal to all parents who are experiencing homelessness and have young children. And it just sort of, you know, kind of gives them hope and encouragement. And it's not like these are the three most extraordinary mothers that have experienced adversity, that these are mothers that, you know, have done well in a way that all mothers who are just fiercely, you know, invested in the lives of their children, despite whatever adversity they experience, are gonna survive and thrive.
Yeah, it is interesting, especially I've known two of the Melissas for a long time, basically, and one of them I've met just since the book. And one of the things that reminds me most about the women I've met over the years who are experiencing homelessness is, as you're talking to them, you're so struck by how resourceful, fun, interesting, intelligent. You know, the one of the nicest things about the three Melissas in the three Melissas book is they aren't unique. They aren't unicorns. And I hate the unicorn story. You know, child born to poverty graduates top of their class from Harvard, right? Well, yeah, a lot of children born to poverty do just amazing things, but they don't get that Harvard stamp. So no one talks about them, right? But they aren't unicorns. They are what moms and dads and people experiencing homelessness have to put themselves through to protect their children. And so when you get to know them and you see how bright and funny, great senses of humor, all three of them, resourceful, different talents. One of the Melissas is an incredible chef, although they all have had to cook with absolutely the most desperate situations. You're thinking, wow, how could we, as Diane Nyland, who I'd love to quote, says, it must be an incredibly wealthy country to throw these people away, right? What are we throwing these people away for? So Diane, when you approached the Melissas, what was their reaction?
Well, I guess I was not surprised that they wholeheartedly embraced this idea, because I've been in contact with one Melissa from 20 years ago, and then one probably 10 years ago, and one, well, 10 or so years ago. So I've known them, I've seen them, I've listened to them, I've learned from them, and I knew that they would be more than comfortable with the idea of sharing a lot of the personal stories that they've experienced, and doing it for the right reason. You know, they were excited, and that's stayed the same and actually has grown.
I want to bring up here, because you've had a lot of people identified already that have worked with you. How did you enlist Pat's help? Because this is how I got to know you, was tangentially through the stuff that you did with Pat, with the tours you did. How did that come about, and what was that like?
Well, you know, with Pat, when she wrote that article and then we met and all that, we right away decided to do a tour. This meant for me, her living in my little camper with me as we traveled. And it was this time of year in January, and I was down in Atlanta. So she came down there, and we did the Southern Discomfort tour, where we went to different places in the South and spoke to families experiencing homelessness, programs that served homeless kids and families, and, you know, all sorts of folks. And we just, you know, kind of hit it off in the sense that she's a, you know, unconventional journalist, that she was more than willing to get involved in this issue. And she knew the issue of homelessness. So, you know, so we did the first tour, and we didn't kill each other in the, you know, living in a little camper. So it was like, all right, that's a good sign. And we really, we felt like we had something to offer, because we could bring forth stories from local areas about homelessness and family homelessness. And I could tell it was somebody that, you know, like with Diana, it's like, this is somebody who can help the cause and was willing to do what it takes. So that's kind of where we, you know, hooked up then. And we've taken several trips since then. And her love of Kurt Vonnegut, and that's how I met you too, was, And
yeah, we do have that.
Yeah, we have that too. So it, you know, it's just this thing that I've seen in life where everybody kind of, the people who think alike just get together and do what we can do to do good stuff.
And I love the fact that you talked about the Southern Discomfort Tour, because one of the things that attracted me to these tours and talking about them is because of Pat's work in radio broadcasting. She said, this is kind of a thing that we do in radio broadcasting, is we have these weird names for the tours. What were some of the other names of the tours, clever names that you guys had come up with? We just lost Pat right in the middle of the feed. So if you could hear us, we were talking about the clever names that you had for the tours. Can you speak to that with Diane? And we'll just continue there from there.
I am so glad that Diane brought up the discussion about the Southern Discomfort Tour, because I had been doing a series of stories with a reporter from the Huffington Post about homelessness, and he was studying some people that were staying at the shelter I was working at. And when I told him about the tour that we were going to leave on for the Southern Discomfort Tour, he talked to his editor and they got me a gig. And that's when I started writing for the Huffington Post. And they said, will you keep track of what you're doing while you're on these trips? Will you write stories and journal about homelessness for us? And I did that for about, maybe 8 or 10 years. I wrote for the Huffington Post stories basically from the front lines of homelessness. And it was a really great opportunity to get the story out. One of my favorite ones that I wrote for them was on one of our trips, Diane and my trip. I think it was the Homeless on the Range tour. And we were camped out front of the Speaker of the House's congressional office, and they called the cops on us. So I wrote a Huffington Post about how Paul Ryan tried to get me arrested, which was really, really kind of fun and unfortunately true. Then we did, of course, the Babes of Wrath tour was the biggest one, and that's where we got our name. We call ourselves the Babes of Wrath, like the Grapes of Wrath. And that tour, we retraced the steps the Joads made in the book The Grapes of Wrath as they go down Route 66. All the things that are in that book are just so important. The burning of the oranges when there are people starving so that the price of oranges stays up. The important things about poverty and the role it plays supporting a dysfunctional capitalism. If you read, people don't often talk about Karl Marx, but let's just talk about him for a minute. If you read Das Kapital and you read the Communist Manifesto, you realize that he doesn't call for violence. He predicts violence if capitalism becomes predatory, which of course it is in the Grapes of Wrath. And unfortunately, it is all around the world right now. But that it could be tempered with social programs, which it's done beautifully. That's what Social Security is. That's what all kinds of things are that temper that. So anyway, Diane and I named ourselves the Babes of Wrath. We've been the Babes of Wrath ever since. And then I think the coldest trip we ever did, and Diane did not want to go, I brought my own comforter to sleep in the camper, and it still was too cold. But that was the Frostbites tour.
Oh, yeah. I still have my sweatpants and all that I got. I got to get something warmer up here.
One other thing about all this, when we did these tours, Diane and I had an enormous social media presence. It's how we paid for the trip sometimes. You know, the gas was expensive. Traveling was expensive. We, of course, slept in parking lots and outside shelters and all kinds of places. Some beautiful places when we were traveling across the country. But we needed a presence on social media. We could not have had that presence without Max Donnelly, who every time we came up with a tour name, he created the caricatures that made us real.
I just thought again, the book Dismazed and Driven, I had a chance to read that and I didn't even think that's also a practical self-care guide in a certain way too, because your details about what it's like living on the road were amazing. And not just for people that are advocating for the unhoused, but just anybody who does that free living, let's go out on the road thing, that was a pretty interesting guide. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Well, that book was, at the time, it was 15 years into my traveling and living in full-time in an RV. And we're talking little camper, not big, fancy RV. And I had never been in a camper of any sort before I started doing that. And I basically bought one with my own money and got in it and went, oh, my God, what am I doing? And so that was, you know, a book that I didn't want, you know, people are saying, oh, you should write a book about your travels, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, well, I don't want to do that solely because my reason for traveling has always been to get the stories from families experiencing homelessness, film those stories and produce short videos of them. So I was able to incorporate those stories in my book, Dismayed and Driven. So it was kind of a twofer book. Some of it was, yeah, my adventures and traveling. And really, traveling full-time in an RV is just like, oh my God, I never would have imagined. So I was happy to share those stories. But more purposefully was to share the stories of the families and to let people hear from them and then also to tap into the videos that I've made of their stories. So it's, you know, it was just, to me, it was a useful book. And it also gave me time. I was at a friend's in Kansas during the initial COVID shutdown. So that was like, I don't know, 6 weeks or so of sitting in a driveway going, well, I better do something. So I'm going to write this book. And so that's kind of how that book came about. Yeah.
Hi, Pat.
Hey there. Hey, this is just not working. I apologize. I don't know if you want to finish it on your own. You guys, I don't know if they're available on Thursday at all. I'll be back home.
We'll play it by ear because I think we're at about 35 minutes now. Thank you. Bye. Okay, so back to where I was. You have... your current RV is Tilly, and I think it's numbered, right? Like, how many RVs or trailers or whatever have you gone through so far?
I'm on number 3.
Okay. And so that, to me, was a part of what I found in the Dismayed and Driven book was the challenges of that. Can you speak to that as a self-help for people that are just traveling for pleasure even?
Well, you know, I learned everything about RVing from scratch, and that's learning the hard way. So it's a hard life. And anybody that has gone to live in a camper has found out that this is not just smooth and vacation kind of thing. It's like just recently we had a cold spell here in North Carolina, as well as most of the country, and you know, my water froze, my ability to get rid of waste products froze, and my heat went off for a while. And, you know, so it's something that has always kind of just been that little tiny reminder of what it's like to not have your own place to live. So I, you know, it's just been an experience that I never, ever thought I would. I used to make fun of campers or RVers, and I was a tent camper. So, you know, it's like, oh, I hate getting behind those RVs. They're so slow. Well, now I drive one and, you know, it's that kind of thing for somebody else. So that's a humbling acknowledgement. But, you know, the thing with me has been, it has forced me to just keep what's important around me and get rid of everything else and stuff. Stuff is an issue that I've had to, you know, realize that, you know, stuff is not going to make me happy because I don't have room for stuff. So it's been a lifestyle that I never would envision. But after 20 years, I feel like I had something in my book to offer some good advice. It's not exactly the Blue Highways kind of book that William Leistheat Moon wrote, but it's my Blue Highways. Because I did a lot of mostly back roads.
It's interesting you talk about being able to let things go. My wife does some downsizing, senior downsizing and things like that. And it really is an unbelievable advantage, luxury to be able to hold on to stuff. And in this subject that we're talking about, being unhoused, that's a luxury that just isn't available. And so it's good to, like, we've been highlighting the lived experience and how important that is, but to even experience a small portion of that and be able to relate that and then bring in the real voices of the lived experience is important. So, Diane, I want to go back to you on this because I also had experience as a former educator. I really appreciated the way that you looked at those students that were perceived as being lesser for whatever reason, because it is, every student is just so incredibly wonderful. Can you share something with us about all of that?
Yeah, you know, there was an experience that comes to mind. I was teaching, it was actually in Ohio at the University of Akron, where I had a class of students, and they were, you know, first generation students. They were single parents. They were young. They were, you know, in their mid-20s, 30s, going back to school after raising kids. And, you know, so it was just a really mixed bag of families. And I had a child at the time that had gotten sick, and it could possibly have been a very serious ailment. And I had to take him to the hospital, and we were going through lots of scary tests and things. And just sitting in the lobby, and right across from me was a mother from one of my classes who had a child in the same situation. And, you know, I certainly didn't know, and she certainly didn't know my situation, but it was just that moment of connection there where I think we both realized that we had more in common than we thought. And, you know, we were just really that, you know, bond of support there in a very serious and sad situation, that was just a commonality there that I think pointed out to me that my circumstances and situation was not very different from hers, and pointed out to her that people who are teachers and in sort of authoritative roles, they're not so different from them either. So I think it was kind of that mutual moment of awareness in a time that we were both very vulnerable and scared, and just ended up being a real support for one another.
Yeah, that really touches me. It's that thing of having three children of my own. There are certain things in life that are just so important, and we often overlook those. And it's interesting just how those get brought back to our minds that way. Diane, I know a little bit about your background prior to getting into the homeless advocacy, but Pat's not here to bring that up. Can you share with us what you were doing before you transitioned into this world that you're currently occupying?
Well, it's, you know, it's just my life has taken these little turns that I never would have expected. I was running the homeless shelter for 15 years. I did that and learned everything I could about what that was about, and just was amazed. But then in the process, because of my involvement with the homeless education law, I was able to move into a position in Illinois right after the McKinney-Vento Act passed. They had regional offices of education, kind of there were seven of us, I think. But so I had eight counties in the Chicagoland area, where I was responsible for 305 school districts doing the McKinney-Vento Act the way they're supposed to. And I did that for 2 years. And I realized that school districts, some were doing tremendous work for families and students, and then some were not. Some just didn't know. And then I encountered some that, you know, there were some real stubborn school administrators that didn't want homeless kids in their schools. But every time I would get involved with a family who was having trouble getting their kids into school, I would listen to their stories and I'd go like, people need to hear these stories. And so one plan was to get a grant, which I did with a colleague in DC, and we were going to hire a film company to just record stories of kids talking about school and what homelessness was like. And that, I think that kind of set off my my supervisor, and they, you know, instead of having them say, oh, that's a great idea, they're like, oh, your program is done. So I was like, oh, no, wait, I'm 55 years old, and I thought I was going to be doing this for a while, and now what am I going to do? And I'm like, wait, I'm going to do that film. So I decided at that point to start a nonprofit, Hear Us, and to sell my stuff, get rid of my townhouse and buy a camper and hop on the road. So that's the short story of how I ended up on the road 20 years ago.
Yeah, I can relate to that. The idea that you're forced into something that you didn't expect to do, because this podcast literally is a part of that same thing. I was forced out of a job and forced into retirement after 20 years in the Navy and 16 years as a teacher. I was kind of forced into retirement, not as a teacher. I'd already retired from there, but in another job I'd taken on. And this grew out of that. Yeah. It sounds difficult, but it's not a bad thing.
I understand how that goes.
Well, the advantages.
Well, let me throw something out that, you know, Pat and I hit it off right, and Diana and I hit it off right. And I want to say that I've identified at least one of the traits in our relationship that makes that happen. And that is the lack of the feeling of entitlement. You know, there's a lot of do-gooders out there, and I don't want to criticize, but this is going to come across like that. But, you know, it's like people are doing good because they'll be seen as somebody special, and you know, then that gives them prestige and whatever, and they can,
yeah, the ego thing,
yeah, they can brag about it and all. You know, both Diana and Pat are so far from that it just makes working with them on this kind of thing just totally special to me, because I don't have to navigate the egos and you know, it's like we're all in this for the same reason, and it is something that I really appreciate.
Well, and that's the reason that you're being recognized as a secular saint, and I truly believe that. I know that you've done some of the videos. I think I've seen portions of some of the videos you've done, and Pat has worked closely with a documentarian on the unhoused as well. Are any of your videos available to the viewing public? And I probably should know that, but I don't.
Well, as a matter of fact, yes, they are all available. And if you go to the Hear Us website, there's a site that I think it says about homelessness or something, and videos. And so it will give you a menu of pretty well all my videos. So it's, there's a lot of them. I mean, I went from not knowing anything about video making at all to to going, well, I probably have close to 100 videos that I've filmed and produced, and actually I'm quite proud of them. And my book Dismazed and Driven, this a lot of the stories that are in there of the families also have matching videos, so you could actually see the families and meet them and hear them. So it's been kind of a neat thing.
So we're at a point where we have the opportunity to talk about an inspiration for you. So a part of the Sacred Legions kind of format has been that we have a designated secular saint and we have the partner that they bring in to accompany the interview. So that's why we have you and Diana today. But we also have this short segment where we go out and we kind of confront someone who inspired you and say, did you know that you inspired a secular saint, and try to get their reaction to it, right? And you listed as your saintly inspiration Melissa Nason, who I believe is one of the three Melissas for the book, correct? Right. So we're going to talk to her for a little bit.
And we have Melissa Nason with us right now. Hey, Melissa.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. What do you feel about the fact that you inspired the woman who changed the lives of kids across the country? Millions of children have gone to school because of Diane Nyland.
It is amazing. I'm humbled, actually, because to me, it's the other way around. She's my greatest mentor. She's, you know, the person that, you know, hands down has been there with me, for me, and by me and mine since we met. So I consider her my inspiration. And so to hear that, it was, you can't even put it into words when, you know, somebody that means that much to you sees you that way. And that's one of the things that I love most about her, is she brings out in people things that they don't necessarily see within themselves. We met through another mentor of mine when my girls were 12 and 9, around that age. And my son was, he was one, maybe two, he was little when we met. And this was right after Ivan. And we had been homeless before. We had been, you know, in shelter and went into transitional housing. And then we, you know, finally acquired our own housing. And then Ivan hit and took everything that I had rebuilt. And that's when she came into the picture, and it was for my own four walls. And it was just, she was amazing to work with. My son is, he has autism. And so he was very, you know, and this was early on before I got him diagnosed, and he didn't really take to a lot of people. And my girls didn't either. When you're in the situation that you're in, it's very hard to kind of trust anybody, let alone trust strangers. And she was just, there's something about her aura and her energy, and she just exudes safety and security and peace and support. And we were able to, my girls, you know, were able to talk to her, and I was able to open up to her. And it just was the beginning of one of the most amazing relationships that I've ever had, because she's the only one that, from that point on, there's not anything that I could say or do or feel that she didn't hear and that she didn't listen to, and that she has just been amazing. And to see where she took this is even, and to be a part of it, it's just been a blessing for everyone. And she was definitely a blessing for my family, and such, she's encouraging. And for a woman that, I don't know, she just, I saw this meme the other day, and it talks about your two places that you want to aspire to be in your life is, you know, some place that brings you peace and some place that inspires you. And when I saw that, I was like, my place is a person, and Diane Nyland is that person for me.
Diane, another aspect of the web podcast that we have here is that we seek resources for individuals that are interested in either volunteer or self-care. So similar to what I was talking about with your books being really helpful for people who need personal help, and people that are interested in just helping you, like Diana, that volunteered to help you in this organization. What is the organization that you would recommend for someone that's interested in either volunteering or getting self-care for your work?
Well, that's an interesting question, Max, because as Diana and I were going through and putting in some resources into our book, the Three Melissas book, you know, you just come to realize that there's not a lot of organizations that really do a lot for families experiencing homelessness. But what does happen in every school district across the country is that there's a homeless liaison that works for the school district that is the person, theoretically at least, that is, you know, in charge with helping families, the students that are homeless. And so they are typically beleaguered. They're overwhelmed and could use all the help they can get. So I think Diana would agree and chime in on this. But, you know, contacting a school district and asking to speak to the homeless liaison when they have a free moment, which is not typically that free, they could use all kinds of help. So that would be one. There's no association, right? Diana, am I like missing something?
Yeah, I think, I think the liaisons play such a central role in supporting the children as well as the parents that would be the first contact. And, you know, just kind of as an example, there have been a lot of things that I've been able to get going in Greensboro, working with the homeless liaison, doing things like, you know, encouraging people to contact schools or the liaison and ask about tutoring opportunities, to ask about one of the things that we just recently did was providing going through the homeless liaison and providing a meal to families that are staying in hotels over the holidays. The Christmas holidays were extremely long this year. And so this group got together and put together a hot meal and took it to the families in the hotel. Doing things like providing food for children to take home over the holidays and things like that. And even monetary support. I mean, that's kind of a big thing. The McKinney-Vento covers a lot of needs for children experiencing homelessness and things that the school district is required to do. But there's an awful lot that the schools can't provide for homeless families. And there's a big role for individuals and organizations to step in and just provide that extra source of funding for things like emergency shelter, emergency payment for staying in hotels or helping families with utilities or things like that. So I think, the liaison is kind of the venue for really understanding how you can be most direct in helping homeless families with children.
So I want to ask that question. I am a former educator. I taught middle school for 16 years. I did not know that there was a homeless advocate anywhere in my school system. I had no idea. So is that a district level thing or a school level thing? Where are they?
It's not supposed to be a district level thing that people aren't aware of. That's kind of the battle that we've fought for, you know, ever since the passage of the McKinney-Vento Act. And just when we think we've got our arms around it, we, you know, talk to school districts that say, oh, do we have a homeless liaison? Huh. Are we supposed to have a homeless liaison? Huh. In a lot of cases, the information doesn't filter down to the schools. I mean, the school social worker in most school districts, I think the school social worker, if the school is fortunate enough to have a school social worker, is the contact at the school level. And, that person should be aware of the requirements for serving homeless kids. One of the requirements of being a district liaison is that you train people at the schools to understand the law and understand how to enroll kids immediately and what kind of services that you're required to link them to immediately. I would say in the majority of school districts, it's probably the case, but you know, the majority leaves a lot of other schools and school districts out that aren't aware of the law and of the requirements and of the ways to serve homeless kids.
And that's really where R3 Melissa's book, that's the bonus of R3 Melissa's book, is that if somebody takes the time to read those 100 or so pages, they will know way more about the McKinney-Vento Act and what school districts are required to do and why it's so important that they do it. I mean, it's like when you hear from the three Melissas about what this means to them and their kids, you're like, well, I had no idea. So our book really does, in addition to guiding the parents, which is the main purpose, it also will guide the school personnel and anybody in the community that cares to read it. And it's actually more of an interesting read than most people would think. And I'm not prejudiced at all.
Well, I'm glad that you wrote it. I'm glad you wrote all the books that you did. I really appreciate your suggestion on volunteerism here, though, because now I'm thinking, if my school didn't have a homeless liaison in the building, by encouraging people to volunteer just to contact your school to make sure that they have that in place and to remind them of the law could be a huge benefit to many, many children. So I think that's fantastic. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us on this podcast. We haven't dealt with the unhoused issue before on this podcast. This is our fourth episode. And of course, Pat is very, very active. Sorry that she's not here at the end of this, but she's very, very active in promoting, advocating for the unhoused in ways that are phenomenal. And I've had the opportunity to work with her on a very minuscule number of those, but the work that all of you three are doing is fantastic. So I want to thank you, Diane Nyland and Diana Bowman, for joining us today. And thank you for the recommendations on how people can get involved to help become advocates for the unhoused themselves.
It's a pleasure being with you, Max, and Pat, wherever she may be now. Thanks for having us.
It is an absolute joy and pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, Max, I'm back.
Oh, man, I'm so happy that you were able to get back in. Do you have anything to add to this conversation now that we have the opportunity to bring you into it?
Well, I'm really grateful that Diana joined us, and you did a great job, by the way. Thanks for carrying the whole load. One of the things they brought up that was so important was that contacting the homeless liaison at the school systems, that some of these homeless liaisons are so overworked. And if you could help, it will be an enormous help. It is a district position. A school district can have one homeless liaison that does every single school in the district. That's a lot of work. And they usually have another job. They're the school counselor, or they're some other part of the administration. There are other school districts, like the Philadelphia School District, that has 100 liaisons. They don't have to. They could get by with only one. But the Philadelphia School Department has made the commitment to supporting kids experiencing homelessness, and they have that many liaisons. If you want to find your homeless liaison, perfect idea to call the school department. But you can also go to a link that Max is putting on the website, Schoolhouse Connections, and Schoolhouse Connections has a list of every liaison in the country. So, and if that liaison's in transition, at least the phone number will get you the right phone number to ask for the school liaison.
And that's a great activity to get involved in too, to contact them and provide your support to them, but also just make sure that they know that they're there.
Yeah. And I don't ever recommend even trying to meet the kids. It's just too much. So if you're going to be supportive, you'll be behind the scenes, but that's great. You know, if you want to get everybody in your office together and say, look, we're going to call the school liaison and tell them if there's a kid in crisis, a kid who needs sneakers. I've had kids go to school, back to school in August in winter boots because that was the only thing that fit. And, you know, that's just cue the bullies. Here's a kid wearing winter boots in August. You know, they got nothing else to wear. So, you know, you could be a huge help. And if your whole office kicks in $5, boom, the kid's got a pair of shoes, right? So there are things you can do, and you can make an enormous difference in a kid who's just struggling to survive. And sometimes, as you know, if you watch Diane's great videos that are all on her YouTube channel, or if you read her books, these kids have got a lot. They're dealing with a lot. And sometimes school is the only stability they have.
I know, too, you wanted to bring up the situation with HUD right now. Because we've got obviously a big problem with a lot of organizations related to the federal government. What can you tell us about what's going on with HUD at the moment?
What's most important to know is that at first, when the executive order came out, or the memo came out from the Office of Budget Management or whatever, they said that all HUD funding would stop, all federal funding would stop, including all HUD funding. That affects millions of people, really, from beginning to end. And that was rescinded. There was an injunction against that memo, and then it was rescinded. That doesn't mean that they haven't just decided to turn around and come at it from another direction. But in the meantime, the DEI order, eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion from all government agencies, has cost a lot of agencies and individuals their jobs. So in HUD for the last many years has been trying to focus on having people with lived experience do the job of addressing homelessness, having people of color do the job of addressing homelessness, not having them do it, but making sure that they're at the table, making sure that LGBTQ people are at the table to help solve the problem of homelessness, especially people with lived experience, because if people who have experienced the problem aren't there to solve it, you're not going to get a real solution. And that shows, right? We've done it the wrong way for too long. And we finally, I mean, I've been in this a long time. Just now we've gotten people with lived experience on those boards. They're being called a DEI hire and they're being sent home. And so there are going to be some real issues. If there was ever a time to get a hold of people, offer to volunteer, make sure that you know your neighbor is still out there, may need you more than ever, it's time to start helping folks experiencing homelessness. So, yeah, I'm really glad that we did the show now. It's important. And, you know, Diana, I'm really the authorities on all this stuff. So it was great to have them.
Absolutely. And again, I want to thank you, Pat, for being able to get back with us. And thanks to all of our listeners. Sacred Legions is a production of Sacred Legions LLC. It is hosted by Max Goller and Pat LaMarche. It's produced by Pat LaMarche. It's recorded and edited by Max Goller. Original music comes to us from the talented Jamie Calland. For more Sacred Legions episodes, visit our website, www.sacredlegions.org, or check us out on your favorite podcast service.